We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And away we go, episode 328 of the Al Galdi Podcast. It is Friday, June 3rd, 2022. It is the day after Game 1 of the 2022 NBA Finals. The NBA Finals! You know the NBA Finals. The annual June reminder that our Wizards are light years away from being NBA championship caliber. That's what the NBA Finals mean to me. As a lifelong Bullets/Wizards fan, a slap-you-in-the-face, oh-so-stiff reminder of how your team ain't close to these two teams playing for an NBA title. Although it feels like every year we see a former Wizard or former Wizards in the NBA Finals. This year, no exception. Otto Porter Jr. on Thursday night. How about him? 4 of 5 on threes off the bench for the Golden State Warriors. What the heck was that when Otto was here? His team, though, lost on Thursday night. The Boston Celtics, a 120-108 win at the Warriors. An incredible comeback by the Celtics. They overcame a 12-point fourth-quarter deficit, won the fourth quarter 40-16. The Celtics became the first team ever to win an NBA Finals game by double digits after trailing by double digits entering the fourth quarter. Hello and welcome to a Friday installment of the Al Galdi Podcast. This show is kind of like the fourth quarter of this work week, being that we had Monday off due to Memorial Day. You know, this also is the day after Ryan Fitzpatrick announced that he is retiring. Washington legend Ryan Fitzpatrick. Fitz magic, we hardly knew ye. You know, we spent so much time last spring and summer talking about what Ryan Fitzpatrick might be and could be as the starting quarterback for the then Washington football team. And of course, what ended up happening? Ryan Fitzpatrick played on 16 snaps in week one, and that was it. He suffered a right hip subluxation and ultimately was done for the season. And then he, like, disappeared, okay? I mean, we never heard from him. We rarely heard about him. There had been no news on him this offseason. Ryan Fitzpatrick had become like a ghost. Let us hope that Carson Wentz this coming season has a better experience as the starting quarterback for our team. Speaking of Carson Wentz, speaking of Commander Carson, lots of Carson Wentz talk on this installment of the Al Galdi Podcast. A special guest is coming up. NFL analyst and Commanders fan Samuel Gold is going to give us the truth about Carson Wentz's final two games with the Indianapolis Colts. Samuel is the creator of Sam's Film Room on YouTube. He has 97,000 plus subscribers to his YouTube channel. And Samuel on his YouTube channel has posted a tremendous film breakdown of Carson Wentz's final two games of the 2021 season. The title of the video is Carson Wentz Being Unfairly Blamed for Colts Downfall. Trust me, you do not want to miss my conversation with Samuel Gold, an in-depth sober, rational analysis of whether the things that pretty clearly drove Wentz out of Indy, his performances over the Colts' final two games of the 2021 season, were all on him. Also, next segment, I will discuss what Carson Wentz could mean for the opening up of the Commanders' offensive playbook this coming season, off comments from Ron Rivera and Scott Turner. And I'll address something that Ron again has brought up: Washington having run the ball so much during the team's four-game winning streak last season. There's a very key point with that that doesn't get brought up nearly enough. I'm going to bring up that point and a few other points as well. Also on the show, a new low for the Nationals this season. A blowout loss at the second worst team in the National League. An 8-1 loss at the Cincinnati Reds on Thursday night. Boy, the Nats really, truly are a bad baseball team. However, I do have some positive news with the Nats to discuss with you. The promotions of two minor league starting pitchers to higher levels of the minors, including a guy who is surging in terms of how he's viewed in the Nats farm system, Cole Henry. And I'll talk Orioles on the show. Bad news regarding their top pitching prospect, Grayson Rodriguez, and also a tough loss for the O's on Thursday night, a 7-6, 10-inning loss to the Seattle Mariners at Oriole Park at Camden Yards. You can tweet me at Al Galdi. You can email me, the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. Email from Rob: hey Al, I am expecting a full segment on Friday's show devoted to the illustrious Wooft Skins career of Ryan Fitzpatrick now that he has retired. I just hope one segment is enough. You think he goes into the hall as a Commander? Great show as always. Thank you, Rob. Yes, in fact, there will be a special Saturday installment of the podcast and a special Sunday installment of the podcast to cover all that was accomplished by Ryan Fitzpatrick as a Washington quarterback. Email from Ian Washburn on the Commanders' next stadium being a modernized RFK stadium. Writes Ian: while it's probably not feasible given the political stars that would need to align, it's still fun to dream. We could have things like rooftop seating with views of the Capitol. The untapped equity in RFK could make it a diamond in the rough. A 55,000-seat capacity is key to keeping it real because empty seats are bad. In my opinion, the team averages under 50,000 in Landover these days. Who knows what to believe from team reports on attendance? I know what my eyeballs see on TV. We'll probably end up with a new Danny Dome in Landover, Rao John 2.0, but with a roof. He'll get his one Super Bowl, and then the DMV will be out of the rotation, stuck with another crappy stadium for the next 30 years. By the way, did you ever make it to RFK for football in the glory days of your youth? Thank you for the email, Ian. You know, you're right. A modernized RFK stadium, or a new stadium on the RFK stadium site, could be outstanding. You're also right in that such a stadium probably isn't feasible. And out of all of the Commanders stadium news of the last few weeks, and there have been so many things, right? But out of all of the things, no item to me has been more annoying than what the Washington Post reported this past Tuesday evening, that according to Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, a disagreement between D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser and D.C. Council Chairman Phil Mendelson, quote, has for months prevented the introduction of a bill in Congress that would allow the city to buy and develop the abandoned RFK Stadium space, end quote. As you likely know, the biggest obstacle to the Commanders' next stadium being where so many people want the stadium to be, the RFK Stadium site in Washington, D.C., has been that the federal government, not the city of D.C., owns the RFK Stadium land. Well, we apparently have a potential fix for this via this bill, but the bill isn't being introduced to Congress because Bowser and Mendelson aren't on the same page, at least according to Eleanor Holmes Norton. Typical Washington, D.C. politics. I am not one of these people who believe that the Commanders' next stadium has to be in D.C., but I totally recognize that the Commanders' next stadium being in D.C. would be very well received by fans of the team. That may well be the biggest public relations home run that Dan Snyder could have right now, figuring out a way for the team's next stadium to be in D.C. Did I ever go to a Redskins game at RFK Stadium. No, I did not. When I was growing up, tickets to Redskins games at RFK Stadium were legitimately difficult to get. The waiting list was a real thing, not a fake thing. So I have only been to Redskins games at FedEx Field. Oh, so lovely, FedEx Field. I have attended a Nationals game at RFK Stadium. September 2007, I was at a Nats-Philadelphia Phillies game at RFK Stadium with Steve Zabin, Steve Solomon, and Tom Lavero. Quite the crew. Good times. I think that we may have been the only people there who were rooting for the Nats. Email from Sean on Ron Rivera and his future as Commanders head coach. Right, Sean? Hey, Al, I could wax poetically about how the Commanders seem to lack the foresight to be proactive and always seem to be reactive. I could talk about how the head coach and front office seem to have antiquated mindsets and are out of place in the present-day NFL. You need to be aggressive with trades and targeting free agents. The team is not. I could expound on how surely this free agency approach and draft will no doubt bring the flock of lost Commanders fans back to FedEx Field this year in droves, correct? I could talk about how in this draft, the team seemed to once again at best have drafted for need instead of trying to stockpile the roster with the most talented players. Believe me, there is a long rant that I could disperse, but why? I'm not alone in my thoughts. I do have one question that I've not seen discussed anywhere. I could be grasping. Here goes. This narrative that Ron Rivera keeps pushing this year three being so important to the team, making this big jump. We've tried to find this hot seat that seems to be the origin of his mindset. However, we also know that Dan Snyder doesn't fire coaches with years left on their deals anymore. So, query, is this self-placed hot seat from Rivera, him actually stating that if he can't turn this around in year three, he's going to walk? I know. He's not going to walk away from the contract. However, humor me. Could it be that the seemingly daily drama with the team has gotten to him? Could it be he places his long-term health above the contract? Could it be he deems if he can't bring the fan base back this year, he's over it? Random question. Thanks, and you and yours stay healthy. Well, thank you for the email, Sean. Wow, so could Ron Rivera walk away, step down as Commanders head coach after this coming season if the team does not do well this coming season? Well, anything is possible, okay? You never say never. But I would be really surprised if Ron did that. It would look pretty bad for Ron to quit after three seasons as head coach of the team with it having had a losing record in each of those seasons. Ron, of course, is more than just the Commanders head coach. He is the head coach in a coach-centric approach. He has final say-so on football operations. He is the Don of the Commanders Mafia. He is, as I call him on this podcast, Don Ron. So him stepping down after three losing seasons would be an indictment of him as not just a head coach, but also as a player personnel man. Now, I get the premise. Ron would be stepping down because of all of the off-the-field stuff with the team. But, you know, as best as I can tell, Ron is not dealing with the off-the-field stuff all that much anymore. He was in 2020 when he essentially was running a one-man operation, and of course he was doing this while battling cancer. But Ron now basically only focuses on football, with Jason Wright and other people handling the non-football stuff. Now, that's not to say that Ron doesn't at all deal with the non-football stuff, but things like the stadium search and the workplace misconduct scandal and the financial scandal and Congress investigating the Commanders and the name change, all of that primarily is being dealt with by Jason Wright and Dan and Tanya Snyder and their lawyers. As far as we know, Ron is healthy and is feeling well. You know, Ron now is 60. That is true. And like I said, you never say never, okay? You never know what's going through someone's mind. But I would think that if Ron is out as Commanders head coach after this coming season, that'll be because he was fired, not because he stepped down. And I think that it would take a really bad season, like a complete debacle of a season, for Dan Snyder to fire Ron Rivera as head coach after this coming season. I think that Ron has said the stuff about the 2022 season needing to be a step forward season for the Commanders because he's trying to set the bar high, and he realizes that it is time for his rebuild to start resulting in more actual wins. And let's be honest, from a business standpoint, especially with the new name, the team very much needs to have a winning season. Remember, the team has not had a winning season since the 2016 season, and the team hasn't had a double-digit win season since 2012. That is a long time ago now. Well, getting the job done for a long time, as a Washington, D.C.-based law firm has been Paulson and Nace. If you have a case, you should contact Paulson and Nace. Paulson and Nace handles medical malpractice, personal injury, birth injury, legal malpractice, and consumer protection cases, offering aggressive advocacy for victims in Washington, D.C. and West Virginia. If you or someone you love is dealing with injury through no fault of your own or his or her own, call Paulson and Nace, 202-902-7611, and tell Paulson and Nace that Al Galdi sent you. Paulson and Nace is widely respected throughout Washington, D.C. and West Virginia for the firm's accomplishments both in and out of courtrooms. Chris Nace and Matt Nace are dedicated trial attorneys who do not balk in the face of large insurance companies or well-known businesses whose practices or products are directly related to the root of your harm. Paulson and Nace does not accept low settlement offers that benefit the people who caused clients harm more than the offers benefit the clients. Paulson and Nace is not afraid to take a case to trial, and Paulson and Nace wins trials. Paulson and Nace has secured millions of dollars in verdict and settlement amounts for clients to better enable them to care for themselves and their families. Again, if you have a case, contact Paulson and Nace. If you feel that you've been wronged, if you think that you've been wronged but aren't sure, call Paulson and Nace and schedule a no-obligation appointment. Yeah, you're obligated to nothing. Call Paulson and Nace at 202-902-7611. That's 202-902-7611. When you call, make sure that you tell Paulson and Nace that Al Galdi sent you. Schedule a no-obligation appointment by calling 202-902-7611. You can also visit PaulsonandNace.com. That's PaulsonandNace.com. Just make sure that you tell Paulson and Nace that Al Galdi sent you. Paulson and Nace. If you have a case, contact Paulson and Nace. All right, before we get to our special guest, NFL analyst and Commanders fan Samuel Gold on the truth about Carson Wentz's final two games with the Indianapolis Colts, let us talk some Carson Wentz right now. Let us discuss our Commanders starting quarterback. So here's a take that may sound like a hot take, but really isn't a hot take. Carson Wentz is our team's most talented quarterback since Robert Griffin III. Go through all of the quarterbacks who our team has had since peak RG3 in 2012. Not a single one of those quarterbacks has been as talented, as physically gifted as Carson Wentz's. Now, that doesn't mean that Carson Wentz is the best quarterback who our team has had since peak RG3 in 2012. The best quarterback who our team has had since peak RG3 in 2012 was Kirk Cousins in 2015 and 2016. But neither Kirk nor any other Washington quarterback since peak RG3 has been as talented as Carson Wentz is. He is big. He is listed as being 6'5 and 237 pounds. He has a cannon for an arm. He can move, maybe not like he could in 2016 and 2017, but he still can move. Carson Wentz finished the 2021 regular season at number 9 among all qualified quarterbacks in the NFL in ESPN's clutch weighted expected points added through rushes. That's a fancy schmancy stat, but that's one of the best ways of evaluating how much production a quarterback provides through rushing. And Carson Wentz, last regular season, it was top 10 among all qualified NFL quarterbacks in ESPN's clutch-weighted expected points added through rushes. In fact, he finished one spot ahead of Russell Wilson and two spots ahead of Taylor Heineke. Now, speaking of Heineke, of whom I am a fan and of whom I have been a defender, I think that some of the criticism of Heineke at times has been over the top and unfair, and a lot of the Taylor Heineke haters, the Tay-Tay haters, the Taters, as I've called them, have had a convenient habit of moving the goalposts for Heineke. That said, Carson Wentz is more physically gifted than Taylor Heineke is. Carson Wentz last season was a better quarterback than Taylor Heineke was, and so it's not at all unreasonable to say that Carson Wentz is a significant upgrade over Taylor Heineke. Now, maybe Wentz this coming season ends up being worse than Heineke was last season. Heck, maybe Heineke this coming season ends up being the Commanders' starting quarterback. Who the heck knows? But objectively speaking, Carson Wentz last season was a better quarterback than Taylor Heinicke was. Wentz, for the 2021 regular season, had a Pro Football Focus wins above replacement of 1.56. Heinicke's PFF WAR for the 2021 regular season was 0.7. So Wentz in the 2021 regular season per PFF WAR generated more than double the value that Heinicke generated. And so all of this brings us to something that I think is quite clear. The Commanders believe that having Carson Wentz as their starting quarterback is going to allow them to do things on offense that the team has not been able to do over the last two seasons with its quarterbacks. Both Commanders head coach Ron Rivera and Commanders offensive coordinator Scott Turner pretty clearly seem to believe this. This was Scott at his post-OTA practice press conference on Wednesday morning on what having Carson Wentz as a QB1 can unlock for Scott's offense.
There's a lot of different things that he's capable of doing. Obviously, very skilled player. You see him out of practice, he's a big physical guy. He can really push the ball down the field. Our group of receivers doing a great job of running, getting open, and he's finding them, you know. So just being able to work with him day to day, and you're kind of learning, you know, the things he's capable of, and there's not a lot that he's not.
Yeah, and of course, being capable of things is one thing. Actually doing those things is another. You heard Scott Turner make mention of Carson Wentz being capable of pushing the ball down the field. This has become an annual topic. Washington needing to be better at generating deep passes. Washington, for the 2021 regular season, per Sharp Football Stats, ranked just 24th. Out of 32 NFL teams in explosive passing play rate. Sharp Football Stats defines an explosive passing play as a pass that goes for at least 20 yards. Washington, for the 2021 regular season, per Sharp Football Stats, ranked just 24th out of 32 NFL teams in explosive passing play rate. In fact, here are Washington's rankings in explosive passing play rate over the last few regular seasons. 2021, 24th. 2020, 31st, as in next to last in the NFL, 2019, 27th, 2018, 27th. Washington has finished 24th or worse in the NFL in explosive passing play rate per Sharp Football Stats in each of the last four regular seasons. Not good. Hopefully Carson Wentz can get the Commanders to being respectable in terms of explosive passing plays. Here was Scott Turner on Wednesday morning on whether he wants his Commanders offense in the 2022 season to be more vertical than the offense has been in each of his first two seasons as a team's offensive coordinator.
Yeah, I mean, you always want to try to do whatever you can to create explosive plays. That's a big part of scoring points. You know, it's hard to consistently drive the field against teams. So when you can get big chunks, you know, that helps you score points. Consistently. So that's always going to be something that we strive to do.
And of course, it should be. Ron Rivera, at his post-OTA practice press conference on Wednesday morning, was asked to define the step forward that he would like to see the team's offense take with Carson Wentz as the Commander starting quarterback. And here was Ron's answer.
Well, what I think is I think I'd like to see the rest of the playbook grow. You know, there are some things that Carson does that, you know, not a lot of other quarterbacks can do with his arm strength, his ability to throw the ball specifically vertically. Do I expect it to step forward? I do. I expect us to be able to really expand on what we've done in the past.
So Ron Rivera right there, quote, what I think is I'd like to see the rest of the playbook grow. There are some things that Carson does that not a lot of other quarterbacks can do with his arm strength and his ability to throw the ball specifically vertically. So yeah, do I expect us to step forward? I do. I expect us to be able to really expand on what we've done in the past. End quote. Ron and I think Scott Turner as well believe that they can do things offensively this coming season that the team could not do in each of the last two seasons due to who was playing quarterback for the team. And if Ron and Scott are right about this and Carson Wentz delivers upon this, then this obviously is a massively positive development for the Commanders. I mean, keep this in mind about Carson Wentz. He in the 2021 regular season ranked number one among all qualified quarterbacks in the NFL in Football Outsiders DVOA metric on deep passes, on passes of at least 20 air yards. That's pretty special. And I think that's something that probably surprises a lot of people. that Carson Wentz was the most efficient quarterback in the NFL last season regarding deep passes. Now, Ron Rivera has talked about how much he liked how much Washington ran the ball during the team's four-game winning streak last season. So on the one hand, Ron wants the Commanders playbook to be opened up more in having Carson Wentz as a team starting quarterback. And on the other hand, Ron wants the Commanders to run the ball a good bit. And so Ron later in his post-OTA practice press conference on Wednesday morning was asked whether it's difficult to marry these two desires.
I don't think it's very difficult at all. I mean, when talking with Scott Turner, and, you know, Norv's here as well, and I've talked with Norv a lot about that, you know, having worked for him for four seasons and having been around him, you know, probably for the last 5 years, you know, that's a big part of it. If you run the ball effectively, you're going to be able to throw the ball effectively. You're going to take the pressure off the quarterback to have to constantly make plays. If you're throwing the ball well, you're going to open up the running game. So to be able to do those things together in a collaborative effort, I think it's going to create some real positive things. As I said, during that four-game streak, those were the things that we did. We ran the ball effectively. I'm trying to remember the exact number, but I believe on the average, we ran the ball something like five or six times more in each one of those wins. And by being able to do that, we take the pressure off the quarterback where he has to make plays.
All right, so a few things from what Ron Rivera said there. First of all, Ron mentioned Norv Turner. I said, Ron mentioned Norv Turner.
This is Coach Norv Turner.
Yes. Hello, Norv. Hello, Norval. Boy, the excitement in that drop is just outstanding.
This is Coach Norv Turner.
Yes, Norv Turner. Something that has been notable at these Commanders OTA practices so far this offseason is the presence of Norv Turner. He has been at quite a few, if not all, of these OTA practices. Now, he did attend some of Washington's practices last year, but it seems like Norv has even more of a presence now. The connections of Norv to the Commanders, of course, are many. He was the Redskins head coach for most of the 1990s, February 1994 to December 2000. His son, Scott Turner, is the Commanders offensive coordinator. And Norv worked with Ron Rivera during Ron's time as Carolina Panthers head coach. Norv was the Panthers offensive coordinator in 2018 and 2019. So I don't know if Norv Turner now has some unofficial role with the Commanders or if he's just helping out his son, Scott, and a good friend in Ron Rivera, but Norv seems to be around more these days. And Ron on Wednesday morning, unsolicited, made mention of Norv. And by the way, I have no problem with Norv helping out the Commanders. I mean, Norv is one of the smartest offensive minds in football over the last 35 years. But also in that cut from Ron Rivera was him essentially discussing marrying a deep passing game with a quality running game. And of course, you can do that. Plenty of teams do that. It's not an either-or scenario. It's not, hey, you need to either be good at throwing the ball deep or be good at running the ball. No, you can be good at both. I got a kick, though, out of Ron again, talking about how a key to Washington's four-game winning streak last season was running the ball so much. I talked about this at the time. I'll say it again right now. This is a chicken and egg thing. Yes, Washington, during its four-game winning streak last season, ran the ball a good bit. But Washington ran the ball a good bit because Washington was holding leads in games. And Washington was holding leads in games because the team's pass defense got better and because the team's starting quarterback at the time, Taylor Heinicke, was playing really well. Washington running the ball a good bit during its four-game winning streak essentially was a result of the four-game winning streak, not the cause of the four-game winning streak. You run the ball more when you're holding leads in games. And generally speaking, you get leads in games with your passing offense, not your rushing offense. Take, for example, the first win in the four-game winning streak, the 29-19 win over the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at FedEx Field in Week 10. Washington in the game led in the second quarter 13-0 and led at the half 16-6. Taylor Heinicke in the first half went 13 of 16 for 129 yards, a touchdown, and no interceptions, and had a 10-yard run. Antonio Gibson, in the first half, had 10 carries for just 18 yards. And one of those runs was a 15-yard run. So his other 9 carries totaled a mere 3 yards. Was Washington's running game the reason for the 13-0 second quarter lead or the 16-6 halftime lead? No. Washington's passing game was the reason, or at least a substantial reason. Taylor Heinicke, a.k.a. Tay-Tay, was the reason, or a reason. And then Washington in the second half did run the ball a good bit. Gibson in the second half of that game, 14 carries for 46 yards and 2 touchdowns. You may remember a great drive that Washington had in the fourth quarter of the game. A mammoth 19-play, 80-yard drive that consumed a ridiculous 10 minutes, 26 seconds off the clock, resulted in Antonio Gibson's 4th-and-goal, 1-yard touchdown run with 29 seconds left in the fourth quarter for a 29-19 lead. So Washington's running game preserved a lead that Washington's passing game and defense established. That's the truth about that win over the Bucs at FedEx Field last season. Now, all of this isn't to say that the Commanders' running game isn't important. It is. All of this isn't to say that you can't establish a lead with your running game. You can. And actually, an example of that would be the fourth game of Washington's 4-game winning streak last season, the 17-15 win at the Las Vegas Raiders in Week 13. Washington in that game led at the half 7-3. Antonio Gibson in that first half, 12 carries, 65 yards, 5.4 yards per carry. Gibson during the 4-game winning streak totaled 95 carries. That works out to an average of 23.75 carries per game. But understand, and I really hope that Ron Rivera understands, that the biggest reason that Gibson had so many carries during that 4-game winning streak was that Washington often was playing with the lead. And those leads were in large part due to Washington's passing game and Washington's improved pass defense. And honestly, the improved pass defense may have been the biggest reason for the winning streak. Washington's pass defense over the team's first 8 games in the 2021 regular season was terrible. Washington's pass defense over a 5-game stretch, weeks 10 through 14, was a lot better. I mean, just look at third down defense. Washington, over its 2-6 start to the 2021 regular season, allowed opponents to go 65 of 115 on third downs. That works out to a third down efficiency for Washington opponents of 56.52%. That is atrocious third down defense. But Washington, during the 4-game winning streak last season, held opponents to just 12 of 39 on third downs. That works out to a third down efficiency for Washington opponents of 30.77%. So this narrative that Washington's 4-game winning streak last season was because the team ran the ball so much is misleading. You got to be careful with that. Well, if you are wanting to buy a home in the Washington, D.C. area, the last thing that you need is to be misled by your real estate agent. You need a real estate agent who is smart, who is creative, and who will listen to you. And so that's why if you are looking to buy a home in the Washington, D.C. area, you got to get with Kellen Hunt. Visit closeitwithkel.com. That's closeitwithkel, K-E-L-L.com. Book a call with Kellen Hunt to discuss your real estate needs and make sure that you tell Kel that Al Galdi sent you. The competition for homes in the D.C. area right now is extreme. High demand coupled with low inventory. And so homes in the D.C. area are going under contract quickly after those homes are listed. And when I say the D.C. area, I mean in a variety of places in the D.C. area. Maryland, Virginia, Washington, D.C. The real estate market throughout this area is hot. How do you make sure that you get the home that you want and deserve? What's the right strategy? This is where Kellen Hunt comes in. Kellen Hunt has a mastery of the D.C. area real estate market, but he's not just some know-it-all. He is here for you. He is here to listen to you, to hear what you want, and then determine the best way of going about getting it. If you are wanting to buy a home in the D.C. area, you need a smart realtor to ensure that your offer is the offer that wins. Put Kellen Hunt to work for you. His website says it all. closeitwithkel.com. Kellen Hunt is a closer. He's 1990 Bobby Thigpen. And Kellen Hunt is willing to put a portion of his commission back in your pocket. Yes, you, the buyer, get a piece of the action, some extra money. Kellen Hunt knows what buyers like you are facing. He wants to help. So let him help. Visit closeitwithkel.com. That's closeitwithkel, K-E-L-L.com. Book a call with Kellen Hunt to discuss your real estate needs and make sure that you tell Kel that Al Galdi sent you. You have nothing to lose. Visit closeitwithkel.com. Book an introductory call with Kellen Hunt at closeitwithkel.com. If you are trying to buy a home in the Washington, D.C. area, trust me, you will do well by going with Kel. Visit closeitwithkel.com and tell Kel that Al Galdi sent you. As is always the case, I appreciate you listening to the Al Galdi podcast. If you have never rated the Al Galdi podcast, please consider doing that. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, you can give the podcast a 5-star rating. Just tap the 5 stars if you're on Apple Podcasts and you're good to go. Also, if you have never written a review of the podcast, please consider doing that. You can write a review of the podcast if you're listening on Apple Podcasts. The review does not have to be long. It can be just a sentence or two saying that you like the podcast. The ratings and the reviews help to make the podcast successful, and I thank you for doing them, and I appreciate you doing them very much. Well, there almost certainly are multiple reasons for why the Indianapolis Colts traded Carson Wentz just 1 year after trading for Wentz. But the biggest reason seems to be how his 2021 season ended. The Colts, through 15 games in the team's 2021 regular season, were 9-6 and poised to make the playoffs, and then came the Colts' final 2 games of the season. Week 17, a 23-20 home loss to the Las Vegas Raiders. Week 18, a 26-11 loss at the Jacksonville Jaguars. Wentz, over these 2 games, had a combined total QBR per ESPN of just 13. His total QBR for the loss at the Jags was just 4.3. Carson Wentz now, of course, is the Commanders' starting quarterback. They traded for him this past March, in case you haven't heard. Wentz did a lot of good things in the 2021 season. He legitimately bounced back from his horrendous 2020 season, what was his final season with the Philadelphia Eagles. But you can't do a proper evaluation of Wentz's 2021 season without bringing up those final 2 games. So what happened? And how much of what happened is on Wentz? I'm very pleased to welcome back to the Al Galdi podcast NFL analyst Samuel Gold. He is the creator of Sam's Film Room on YouTube. He has 97,000 plus subscribers to his YouTube channel, and he on his YouTube channel has put together an excellent film breakdown of Carson Wentz's final 2 games of the 2021 season. The title of the video is Carson Wentz Being Unfairly Blamed for Colts Downfall. And Samuel Gold isn't just an NFL analyst, he also is a fan of the Commanders. You can follow Samuel on Twitter at Samuel R. Gold. Hey Samuel, how are you?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Doing well. So you have done a deep dive on something that I think matters a lot to us as Commanders fans. What is the truth about what pretty clearly played the biggest role in Carson Wentz being traded by the Colts, his final 2 games with the Colts? If you had to summarize your findings, how would you summarize them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And to me, it kind of comes down to 3 major points that I made throughout my video. The first was on Carson Wentz. He did not play well in either game. People are going to first look at the Jaguars game. They're going to see that he threw an interception, and they're going to, it was a really bad interception to be fair. And they're going to see that because he lost that game against the Jaguars, and because of the Colts, they're going to instantly say that's on him and he's the downfall and he's the reason why the Colts didn't make the playoffs. And as I was thinking about this, the Colts were actually 9-6 going into these last 2 games. If they won either, and I look back through NFL playoff scenarios, they would have made the playoffs. And so I went through the Las Vegas Raiders game. I went through the Jacksonville Jaguars games. And my top 3 findings were the following. Carson Wentz was definitely not good enough. He was very inaccurate. His eyes were everywhere in terms of how he was reading the field. I felt like he misread concepts. He just generally did not play the position well. The second thing I noticed was that their offensive line was garbage throughout both of those games. Against the Raiders, they allowed a 52% pressure rate, which is that's ridiculous. Tom Brady, for reference, he had a 21% pressure rate throughout his entire last season. And so this is way more than double that. So their offensive line was garbage. He was under pressure all the time. And as we know, Wentz isn't the best under pressure in terms of creating plays. He can escape the pocket to create plays, but he's not the best in terms of his process, in terms of making the correct throws, in my opinion. So there's that. And then the third thing I noticed was just generally the play calling by the Colts was so overly conservative. It was the Russell Wilson effect. It was, let's run the ball twice and then pass on third down and hopefully we can convert. They did that way too many times, and they kept faulting because they kept forcing him to these third and long and situations like a third and seven, a third and 14, and it was awful.
Maybe the most interesting thing that you said in your video breakdown was that Carson Wentz actually was worse in the Week 17 home loss to the Raiders than he was in the Week 18 loss at the Jags, even though the loss at the Jags is the game that has gotten the bulk of the attention. Why do you feel that Wentz was worse in the Raiders game as compared to what he was in the Jags game?
Yeah, definitely. And that was actually something that kind of surprised me, because it seems like nobody's really blaming him that much for the Raiders loss as compared to the Jaguars loss. But he was way worse in the Raiders game. He was objectively more inaccurate. His lone touchdown was this deep bomb to T.Y. Hilton that was underthrown, and it should have been picked off. There was two guys that collided into each other. It bounced off their hands and right into Hilton's arms for a touchdown. It was ridiculous. Beyond that, yes, they were under pressure 52% of the time as compared to 43% in the Jaguars games, but his accuracy and his ability to set up plays, he just left so many yards on the field. I don't believe it was like that against the Jaguars.
You've noted how much Carson Wentz was pressured in each of his final two games last season. We know that pressure isn't always a function of offensive line play. Pressure also can be a function of the quarterback. And your assessment of these two games, was the majority of the pressure the fault of Wentz, or was he just done dirty by the Colts offensive line?
Yeah, I thought it was a split halfway and halfway. And I know that's not the most attractive answer in terms of getting to the root of the problem. But for example, in the Jaguars game, the Colts offensive line was credited for 6 sacks in that game. I don't believe they're responsible for all 6. I had Carson Wentz down for 3 of them alone. For example, there was one play that I broke down in my video where he started the play on the wrong side and he missed 2 open receivers because of that. He started on the left side. He didn't realize that he had a numbers advantage on the other side, and that's what led to the sack. If he started on the right side, for example, he could have had a seam route that could have been a 20 to 30 yard gain, maybe less. He also could have thrown it in to his check down underneath. And yes, there was a little bit of pressure, but there was time to make a throw, and he could have done that if he just started on the right side. So the speed to pressure did come pretty quickly on that play. But again, if Wentz just started on the other side, it wouldn't have been their fault.
So I think about what Carson Wentz will have with the Commanders versus what he had with the Colts. So Washington's offensive line in the 2021 regular season blew away the Colts' offensive line in terms of pass blocking. Washington for the 2021 regular season for Pro Football Focus had the number 6 offensive line in the NFL in terms of pass blocking efficiency. The Colts for the 2021 regular season had the number 30 offensive line in the NFL in terms of pass blocking efficiency. Then you throw on top of that the Commanders' skill position players having the potential to be much better than the Colts' skill position players. Do you think that it's safe to say that Wentz with the Commanders will be surrounded by a significantly better supporting cast than what he had with the Colts?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think the running back room is better. I think the wide receivers overall, I think we have a better receiving core in Washington, and the offensive line is way better in Washington than when he was with the Colts. And for a guy that kind of struggles when those pressure moments or creates his own pressures, to have just a little more time in order to execute the quick game or something like that, which he's good at, it's going to help him a lot. And I feel like that alone should help him make plays.
We're talking Carson Wentz with NFL analyst and Commanders fan Samuel Gold, who on his YouTube channel, Sam's Film Room, has done a terrific film breakdown of Carson Wentz's final two games in the 2021 season. When it comes to things for which Wentz was responsible, what would you say was most troubling or bothered you the most in evaluating Wentz's final two games of the 2021 season?
To me, it was the inaccuracy. For having receivers open and him just missing them, I think that was the biggest problem, was that when there was a play to be made, something routine like a deep blaze out route on the left side against the Raiders, or a dig route against the Jaguars where You had an inside receiver clearing out, which is often called a dagger concept, and then you have a dig route coming underneath it to sit in that hole. What would happen was that his eyes were everywhere, where he would start looking way left, then come over to his right side, and then he would just throw this pass the instant his eyes found that receiver. And while that may not sound wonky, it led to a very disjointed process, and it constantly led him overthrowing it or simply throwing not with the correct motion, where he would end up only using his arm and not having a full hip motion through his throw. And seeing that in his, what is he, in the sixth year of his in the NFL, that to me is very concerning. I just don't think he's going to drastically improve his accuracy, just mainly unless he just really breaks down his entire throwing motion.
So netting this out, would you say that you now feel better or worse about the Commanders having traded for Carson Wentz?
Good question. For me, it's I was kind of left, I'll just be blunt. I was kind of left a little bit disappointed. And the thing was that it's not that I don't think that Wentz can create plays. And I don't think, and it's not that I don't think Wentz can improve this offense, which he definitely can. To me, it comes down to the level of upside. And we've talked about this before, about spending all that cap space and spending the draft picks to get a guy that only adds maybe at most plus one to your wins above replacement. To me, that's just not good enough in terms of a team building process. But again, what makes me excited is that this team is better than the Colts team. And with Wentz versus Heinicke, I think they actually have a decent shot of making the playoffs.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that the Commanders trading for Carson Wentz requires a multi-level view. No Commanders fan loves that the Commanders paid a pretty good price to acquire Wentz. But there's what was given up in the trade, and then there's what Wentz can be as the Commanders' starting quarterback. I know that you don't love the process of the trade. I don't love the process of the trade. But what do you think that Wentz realistically can be as the Commanders' starting quarterback?
I think the goal with Carson Wentz is that you don't put too much on him. That we have so much talent around our team with Jahan Dotson, who's apparently playing really well in training camp or off-season training activities, with having Scary Terry and having a pretty good running back room. I feel like we have enough talent in order for him to just facilitate with spreading the ball around and him not making mistakes or obvious mistakes or the goal of when we traded for Alex Smith. You know, the goal of where Ryan Fitzpatrick obviously has never been that that game manager type quarterback, but I feel like he probably could have been more of that in Washington because they had the setup for him to do that. I think Wentz could do that if he can get rid of these simple mental mistakes. And the rumor is he's working with Kurt Warner right now on some of them. And actually, Kurt Warner had a really good video on one of his final games too. I think that's fantastic. I hope that helps.
It's funny, Ron Rivera at his post-OTA practice press conference now two Tuesdays ago, so May 24th, multiple times brought up Carson Wentz making good decisions. That pretty clearly is a point of emphasis from Ron for Wentz. So this is the first time that we've spoken since the 2022 NFL Draft. You, in your last appearance on the podcast, episode 298, broke down the top quarterbacks in the 2022 draft. You said regarding Sam Howell that there's a lot of variance with him. He could be a really good NFL quarterback. He could be a really bad NFL quarterback. Well, the Commanders, of course, ended up taking Howell in the fifth round of the draft. I love the pick as a value pick. What do you think of the pick, and what do you think that Howell could be for the Commanders?
Yeah, I was super pumped that they drafted Sam Howell, especially in the fifth round. I thought he would go in the second or the third, so seeing him to fall all the way down to the start of the fifth, I was very happy about that. But you're right, Sam Howell is probably the biggest wild card in this entire draft in terms of the quarterback position. Truthfully, he could be really good, he could be really bad. And the good news is that he doesn't have to start as a rookie. He can go in there. He can compete. He can sit behind Carson Wentz and try to pick up, you know, the positives from him and while learning in the NFL. And then maybe if he shows off that he's good enough, maybe he can start the second half of the season or play a couple games or show off in the preseason to the point where we can say, oh, why don't we actually give Howell, you know, a true run to see if he should be the starting quarterback. you know, as a fifth round pick, you obviously aren't expecting that much. But to me, that's a good thing because it means that we can just test him out. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. It's not the end of the world. And hopefully at that point, we can just grab a star quarterback in the next year's draft and move on.
Do you have any NFL comps for Sam Howell? Does he remind you of any NFL quarterbacks?
Yeah, I do. Two people that kind of think about when I watch him. First, kind of a Baker Mayfield in terms of kind of the throwing motion, kind of the body style, and kind of how he plays in order to extend plays and use his legs. The other guy is honestly Josh Allen, kind of like a mini version of Josh Allen. He's obviously not 6'5" and whatever 240 pounds, but he kind of plays the game like that, where it's he's a gamer, and that's something that I just loved watching when I went through his UNC film. Was that you would think that the play was pretty much dead and he should just dump it, but out of nowhere he'd be 6 yards down the field and running it for his life, and you'd be juking and jiving around defenders. He's an exciting player, and again, it's you have a medium to high upside type player with a fifth round pick. Who cares?
Yeah, no doubt. And I like that second comp, the Josh Allen comp, especially. Final question, as we're now rather deep into the Commanders offseason, what are you thinking about the 2022 Commanders? You said that you could see them being a playoff team. What kind of a win total do you think that we're looking at?
Yeah, that's a really good question. For me, let's see, last year they were 7-10. I think they could conceivably be 9-8 just based on their schedule. They have one of the easiest schedules in all the NFL. I think their team is improved. I think the defense will be even better. I'm pretty bullish in that fact, and I'm hoping the NFC East is still terrible. That a 9-8 record could easily steal a wild card spot, or I mean, shoot, it might even win in the division with a 9-8 record.
All right, NFL analyst and Commanders fan Samuel Gold, the creator of Sam's Film Room on YouTube. Check out his breakdown of Carson Wentz's final two games in the 2021 season. Really good stuff. Samuel, thanks for your time and all the best to you.
Thanks.
All right, up next, I'm talking Nationals. It's one thing for the Nats to get ripped in a three-game sweep at the National League East-leading New York Mets, but the Nats on Thursday night got routed at the second-worst team in the NL, the Cincinnati Reds. How low can the Nats go? We at least did have big minor league news for the Nats on Thursday. This is news that you certainly want to be aware of if you're a Nats fan. I'll get to all of this and more straight ahead.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic. So now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Well, here is a philosophical question for you. If you're a really bad team and you play another really bad team and you get blown out by that bad team, then what does that make you? This is the question that the Nationals are pondering on this Friday, because this is what happened to the Nats on Thursday night. We on Thursday night had the beginning of a four-game series between the two worst teams in the National League, a four-game series for the NL worst Nats at the Cincinnati Reds, who are so bad that they on May 15th lost a game in which they threw a no-hitter. Yes, a 1-0 loss at the Pittsburgh Pirates. The Reds in that game no-hit the Pirates, and yet the Reds lost that game. And what happened on Thursday night is that the Nats got routed at the Reds. The Nats, by that lowly Reds team, got smashed. An 8-1 Nats loss. This off the Nats having just gotten bludgeoned in a 3-game sweep at the National League East leading New York Mets. The Nats in that series lost the 3 games by a combined score of 28-5. So the Nats now have lost 4 consecutive games. The Nats during this 4-game losing streak have been outscored 36-6. Yes, a run differential over the last 4 games of minus 30. The Nats this season now are a National League worst 18-35, and the Nats this season now have the worst run differential in the majors at minus 83. Now, before we go any further, I would like to make mention of some happy Nats news. Things are so bad for the Nats right now. Can we at least acknowledge something good? The Nats on Thursday promoted 2 pitching prospects to higher levels in the minor leagues. Those 2 pitchers, Cole Henry and Jake Irvin. Now, neither guy is some highly regarded prospect in the world of baseball, but Henry's stock in particular is soaring, and each guy is well-regarded within the Nats system. And, you know, always keep in mind, just because a prospect isn't well-regarded on these top prospects lists doesn't mean that the prospect can't end up being good, okay? These prospects lists are not gospel or anything like that. But the Nats promoted starting pitcher Cole Henry from AA Harrisburg to AAA Rochester. The Nats took Henry in the 2nd round of the 2020 MLB draft out of LSU. This season is Henry's age 22 season. Henry, excellent for AA Harrisburg this season. 7 starts, 23 2/3 innings, ERA of 0.76, a whip of 0.59, a strikeouts per 9 innings of 10.2. And the fact that Henry now is at AAA in early June screams that the plan is to call him up to the majors at some point this season. Now, we'll see if that ends up happening, but when you get brought up to AAA in early June, the idea isn't for you to stay there for the rest of the baseball season. The idea is you're doing well. If you continue to do well, then you're going to be called up to hopefully do well at the highest level of baseball there is. You know, it's possible that Cole Henry will be promoted to the majors before the Nats' top pitching prospect, and one of the top pitching prospects in baseball, Cade Cavalli, is called up to the majors. Now, you know, that's a possibility, maybe not a probability, but that is a possibility at this point. We'll see. And then the Nats on Thursday also promoted starting pitcher Jake Irvin from High A Wilmington to AA Harrisburg. The Nats took Irvin in the 4th round of the 2018 MLB draft out of the University of Oklahoma. This season is Irvin's age 25 season, so he's an older prospect, but part of that is him having undergone Tommy John surgery in October 2020. Irvin for High A Wilmington this season, 9 starts, 30 innings, ERA of 150. So there you go. Hope for the future if you're an Nats fan. All we have is the future right now because the present is not so good. The Nats offense remains not so good. The Nats offense on Thursday night in this 8-1 loss at the Reds, terrible once again. Just 1 run. The Nats totaled just 5 hits. The Nats worked just 1 walk. The Nats went 0-for-3 with runners in scoring position. Nats manager Davey Martinez, during his post-game session with reporters, not at all happy with the Nats batters' approaches to plate appearances in this game. Said that the Nats took too many strikes, swung at too many balls. Here really is all that you need to know. The Nats numbers 1-4 batters on Thursday night: Cesar Hernandez, Keibert Ruiz, Juan Soto, and Nelson Cruz. Those 4 guys went a combined 0-for-16 with no walks and 4 strikeouts. Each guy had the exact same line: 0-for-4 with no walks and a strikeout. What's going on with Juan Soto is painful. I mean, he's better than this. Everybody knows it. He will be better than this as the season goes on. But for right now, he is struggling. Juan Soto's OPS for the season now is at 792. His OPS for the season through May 5th was 927. Soto, in less than a month, has seen his OPS for the season fall by 135 points from 927 to 792. The Nats on Thursday night did hit a home run. That was good to see. Josh Bell, as the Nats starting first baseman and number five batter, went 2-for-4 with a solo homer and an infield single. Bell in the top of the seventh, a one-out first pitch, opposite field homer to left field to cut the Nats deficit to 3-1. I got to tell you, Great American Ballpark cracks me up. This is one of the more notorious bandboxes in Major League Baseball. Josh Bell's homer on Thursday night went just 356 feet per Statcast, but that ended up being a homer because the dimensions at Great American Ballpark are what they are. And so Josh Bell hit a home run. Now, this was Josh Bell's fifth home run of the season. This was his first home run since May 7th. I've talked about the power outage that Josh Bell went through and in a lot of ways remains in the midst of. And that homer by Josh Bell snapped a scoreless streak of 27 and a third innings for the Nats. Remember, the Nats got shut out in each of their final two games in the three-game sweep at the Mets, and the Nats were getting shut out in this game on Thursday night until that Josh Bell home run. And then Bell, in the top of the ninth inning, had a two-out infield single on an ultra-slow roller on a 1-2 pitch. If you actually stayed with this game through the game's conclusion, you saw one of the more unique infield singles that you'll ever see. I'm not sure that I've ever seen a grounder travel as slowly as that Josh Bell two-out infield single traveled in the top of the ninth inning on Thursday night. So Josh Bell had two hits on Thursday night. Also with two hits for the Nats on Thursday night was Michael Franco. He is a Nats starting third baseman and number seven batter, 2-for-3 with two singles. Franco in the top of the fifth, a one-out single to left field on a 1-2 pitch, and Franco in the top of the seventh, a two-out first pitch single to center field. But still, bad offense overall for the Nats once again. I mean, you know, the Nats over the last three games have totaled just one run, okay? Like, right there tells you where the Nats offense is at right now. The Nats starting pitcher on Thursday night was Yoan Adone, and this ended up being what we have come to know as a typical Yoan Adone start. He gave up runs, he issued walks, he did do some good things, but he ultimately didn't do enough. Adone allowed three runs in 5 1/3 innings. He gave up six hits, a homer, and five singles. He issued four walks. He recorded four strikeouts. He over his 5 1/3 innings threw 98 pitches, 54 strikes versus 44 balls. All of the runs that Adone gave up in this game came in the bottom of the first. Adone in the bottom of the first allowed three runs. He gave up a one-out infield single to Brandon Drury on an interesting play, actually. So Drury hit a high, and I mean high, chopper to third baseman Michael Franco on a 1-2 pitch. And I want to give Franco credit. He made a nice spinning catch and then a pretty good throw to first baseman Josh Bell. Now, this was a one-hop throw, but the throw was decent. And the throw, I think, was better than what Josh Bell was anticipating because Bell came off the bag when he probably didn't have to come off the bag. I'm not sure if Drury would have been out, but, you know, I think it would have been at least semi-close. Anyway, Brandon Drury got that one-out infield single. Adone issued a one-out five-pitch walk of Tommy Pham, and then came the big blow. Adone giving up a one-out three-run homer to Joey Votto on a blast to right field, despite Votto having been down to the count of 1.12. Now, Adone, after allowing the three runs in the bottom of the first, did then throw 4 1/3 scoreless innings, but Adone put quite a few Reds on base. Adone tossed a scoreless bottom of the second, despite giving up a leadoff single to Albert Almora Jr. Adone tossed a scoreless bottom of the third, despite giving up a leadoff single to Nick Senzel, issuing a one-out six-pitch walk of Tommy Pham, and issuing a one-out eight-pitch walk of Joey Votto, despite Votto having been down to the count of 1.12. Adone tossed a scoreless bottom of the fifth, despite giving up a leadoff single to Matt Reynolds and then issuing a seven-pitch walk of Nick Senzel. Yoan Adone now has made 11 starts this season. He has an ERA of 5.98. He has a walks per nine innings of 5.64. The walks are the thing. Clearly, the walks are the thing with Yoan Adone This guy with his walks is like, you know, Gio Gonzalez on steroids, okay? And, you know, Gio, for all of his problems with walks, never had a walk rate for a season with the Nats like what Adone has right now. Understand, Gio Gonzalez's worst single-season walk rate with the Nats was 4.32 in 2018. Adone's walk rate so far this season is 5.64. That is a sky-high walks per nine innings. Now, Yoan Adone, of course, is young. This is his age 23 season. He is learning. He is hopefully growing. He does throw hard. He does compete. But obviously, the walks need to come down. As for the Nats bullpen on Thursday night, so two Nats relievers combined to allow five runs in one and two-thirds innings, while another Nats reliever was good once again. Erasmo Ramirez allowed three runs in one inning. He, in the bottom of the sixth, faced two batters, got two outs, but he, in what ended up being a five-run red seventh, was charged with three runs and got just one out. He gave up a first-pitch leadoff opposite field home run to Matt Reynolds to right field. Josh Rogers, he officially allowed two runs in two-thirds of an inning. He and the Reds, five-run seventh, issued a one-out six-pitch walk to Joey Votto, then gave up a one-out three-run homer to Kyle Farmer on a bomb to center field for an 8-1 Reds lead, that homer going a projected 400 feet per Statcast. So Erasmo Ramirez and Josh Rogers struggled. And then, with the Nats down 8-1, it was, of course, Paulo Espino time. You know, nothing in our world right now foretells anything more than the Nats being down big in a game foretells Paulo Espino pitching, all right? The Nats, for whatever reason, refuse to pitch Paulo in meaningful, high leverage, or even medium leverage situations. I don't get it. I mean, he has been really good this season. I'm not saying that he's some dominant pitcher, but you know what? Pitching is about getting outs. Like, at some point, evaluating a pitcher has to stop being about the circumstance and even the opposing hitters and just about, okay, does the guy get outs? And Paulo Espino gets outs. What Paulo Espino keeps doing is getting outs. Paulo Espino on Thursday night tossed a perfect bottom of the eighth inning. Now, you could say, well, the Reds aren't very good. You're right. But you know who had trouble getting outs against his Reds lineup? Erasmo Ramirez. You know who else had trouble getting outs against his Reds lineup? Josh Rogers. Paulo Espino on Thursday night, perfect bottom of the eighth. Here now are Paulo Espino's numbers for this season. 18 games, 24 and two-thirds innings, ERA of 2.19, WHIP of 1.09. Again, I'm not saying that he's great. I'm not saying that he's Mariano Rivera. Nobody is saying that. But geez, Paulo was pretty good last season. He has been really good so far this season. Would it maybe be okay to try him in a spot other than when the Nats are down by a bunch of runs? I mean, just something to think about. The Nats have a hard enough time getting outs. Paulo Espino gets outs. Sure, there are nits to pick, okay? But why not give him more of an opportunity than when the Nats are down by, you know, five runs or more? By the way, guess who was number one among Nats pitchers in Baseball Reference's version of wins above replacement of WAR entering Thursday? Paulo Espino. Yes. Paulo Espino entering games on Thursday was number one among all Nats pitchers in BWAR at 0.5. Paulo Espino. I don't know. Call me crazy. Maybe he has earned pitching in a situation other than, you know, opposing team infinity. That's one. I mean, it's crazy to me right now with Paulo Espino. Another topic from this Nats 8-1 loss at the Reds on Thursday night is defense. It's really interesting what will bother people in charge. The Nats' defensive struggles have really bothered President of Baseball Operations and General Manager Mike Rizzo and Manager Davey Martinez. We have heard each guy sound off on the defensive struggles over the last few days. And you know what? For good reason. The Nats defense has been a real problem so far this season. Well, the Nats' new starting shortstop, Luis Garcia, had some tough defensive moments on Thursday night. Look, Luis's defense is what kept him at AAA Rochester for so long this season, and his defense on Thursday night was an issue. Now, I want Luis Garcia playing. I think a lot of you listening want Luis Garcia playing. It makes a lot more sense for the rebuilding Nats to have Luis Garcia in his age 22 season making defensive mistakes than watching Alcides Escobar in his age 35 season making mistakes. But there's no question that Luis Garcia is a work in progress at shortstop, which isn't an easy defensive position to begin with. Like, you can be really good defensively and still have issues at shortstop. Luis Garcia right now is learning to be good defensively, and he's playing one of the more premium defensive positions in baseball in shortstop. So Luis Garcia on Thursday night was the Nats starting shortstop in number 8 battery, went 0-for-3 with a strikeout, left 3 men on base. Garcia in the bottom of the 4th committed a went-out throwing error on a grounder by Albert Almora Jr. Garcia fielded a one-hopper off the bat of Almora, then made a one-hop throw that pulled first baseman Josh Bell off first base. And in this instance, Josh Bell had to come off the bag. And I want to give Josh Bell credit. He made a nice backhanded catch of the Luis Garcia throw while falling down. Josh Bell, I mean, that was not an easy catch to make. Bell made that catch, but that very clearly was a throwing error by Luis Garcia. And then Garcia in that Reds 5-run 7th had multiple defensive fails, although I'm almost hesitant to use that word fails because the fails came on 2 challenging plays. These were not easy plays to make, but a good shortstop makes one, if not both, of these plays. So Luis Garcia failed to make a stab of a grounder while sliding on his knees on a ball that was hit up the middle by Nick Senzel for a single. If you watch this play, this was an awkward-looking attempt at a sliding catch by Luis Garcia. I mean, this looked like a play on which if you're going to make a diving attempt, you got to dive all out. You got to dive like stomach first. Instead, Garcia tried to do this awkward like slide on his knees, and he ended up not making the play. And then on the very next pitch, it's amazing how this can work, right? Garcia failed to make a diving stab of a well-hit ball off the bat of Brandon Drury for a single. Now, that was a well-struck ball by Brandon Drury. So, like I said, these were not easy plays to make, but, you know, Luis Garcia right now has a spotlight on him with his defense because everybody knows it was his defense that kept him at AAA Rochester, not his offense. I mean, Luis Garcia was raking at Rochester, but the defense is the concern, especially, like I said, with Luis Garcia playing a very key defensive position in shortstop, or at least the Nats wanting Luis Garcia to play shortstop. He, of course, also can play second base. We saw Luis Garcia play a lot of second base for the Nats at the major league level last season. A defensive bright spot for the Nats on Thursday night was catcher K-Bert Ruiz. He was the Nats starting catcher and number 2 batter, went 0-for-4, but Ruiz in the bottom of the 4th threw out Albert Almora Jr. on an attempted steal of second base for the second out. So Almora got on base in that bottom of the 4th via the throwing error by Luis Garcia, but then Albert Almora Jr. quickly was removed from the base paths by the defensive work of K-Bert Ruiz. He gunned down Almora on an attempted steal of second base for the second out. You know, K-Bert Ruiz now this season 9-for-23 on runners trying to steal. That's good. That's impressive. And also, I want to give credit to Nats second baseman Cesar Hernandez. He made a nice tag on that play. So really nice to see something like that. But yeah, I mean, 8-1 at the Reds is 8-1 at the Reds. There is only so much positivity that you can pluck from a game like this one, losing in blowout fashion at a team that has been as bad as the Reds have been so far this season. Game 2 for the Nats at the Reds is on Friday night at 6:40. Josiah Gray will be the Nats starting pitcher. So Josiah Gray last pitched in the Nats 6-5 win over the Colorado Rockies at Nationals Park this past Sunday afternoon. 1 run in 5 innings. He gave up just 3 hits, a homer, and 2 singles. His biggest problem was that he issued 4 walks. He recorded 3 strikeouts. He threw 93 pitches over the 5 innings. Now, it's interesting. Gray began his outing by giving up a leadoff homer to Charlie Blackmon to right field on the 2nd pitch of the game, and that was the last thing that you wanted to see off Gray, having allowed 9 home runs over his previous 4 starts. But Gray then was better, and it was nice to see him be better because he really had struggled in his previous start, which came in a 9-4 loss to the Los Angeles Dodgers at Nationals Park on May 24th. Josiah Gray in that game, 7 runs in 3 innings. He gave up 3 home runs in that game. The home run has been the problem for Josiah Gray so far this season. And, you know, I think as everyone listening knows, Josiah Gray working out for the Nats is a big deal. Like, to me, his starts matter more than any other pitcher's starts for the Nats at the major league level right now. That'll change if slash when Cade Cavalli gets called up to the majors and or Cole Henry gets called up to the majors. But for now, there are Josiah Gray starts, and then there are everyone else's starts in terms of big picture importance for the Nats. Well, Josiah Gray this season, over 10 starts, has an ERA of 5.08. He has looked good in a good number of his starts, but he's had some rough ones here lately. Was better in his last outing. I'm really anxious to see how he does in this game two at the Reds on Friday night. Well, Thursday was not a good day for the Orioles. Bad news during the day, and then a frustrating loss at night. So the bad news during the day had to do with the Orioles' top pitching prospect and the man who is the top pitching prospect in baseball, Grayson Rodriguez. So Grayson Rodriguez in a 9-8, 10-inning home loss for the AAA Norfolk Tides to the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp on Wednesday night. Tossed 5 2/3 scoreless innings, but he left the outing due to right lat discomfort. Well, Orioles Executive Vice President and General Manager Mike Elias on Thursday spoke to reporters and said that Rodriguez will be out for, quote, probably a decent amount of time at a minimum, end quote. We still don't know exactly what the injury is, but the expectation had been that Grayson Rodriguez was soon going to be called up to the majors to make his major league regular season debut. He has been outstanding this season. Rodriguez, over 11 starts for Norfolk this season, ERA of 2.09, whip of 0.84, strikeouts per 9 innings of 12.86. MLB Pipeline ranks Rodriguez as the number 3 prospect in baseball and the number 1 pitching prospect in baseball, but now it appears as if he'll be out for a while. And then came a frustrating loss for the Orioles on Thursday night, a 7-6, 10-inning loss to the Seattle Mariners at Oriole Park at Camden Yards. The O's ended up losing 2 of 3 games in the series. The O's this season now are 22-31. The O's did overcome a 6-3, 6-inning deficit with 3 runs in the bottom of the 6th, but then gave up a run in the top of the 10th on a 1-out triple by Abraham Toro off Jorge Lopez. Lopez worked 2 3rd innings in this game. He allowed just the unearned run in the top of the 10th, during which, of course, we had the automatic runner. But also for the O's in this game, reliever Joey Crable left the game with right shoulder discomfort. That's obviously concerning, especially considering how many pitchers the O's are without right now due to injury. Jordan Lyles was the Orioles' starting pitcher on Thursday night. He struggled, 5 runs, 4 earned in 5 innings. He gave up 9 hits, 3 doubles, and 6 singles, issued 2 walks into wild pitch, had 3 strikeouts. He over 83 pitches through just 48 strikes versus 35 balls. A second consecutive game for Lyles in which he allowed 9 hits. Lyles in a 5-3 loss at the Boston Red Sox this past Saturday afternoon in game 1 of a doubleheader allowed 3 runs in 4 3rd innings. He gave up 9 hits in that game, 3 doubles and 6 singles. In fact, Lyles now has allowed 3 doubles in each of his last 2 starts and has allowed 6 singles in each of his last 2 starts. 11 starts now for Lyles this season. He has an ERA of 4.50. 2 offensive bright spots for the O's on Thursday night were Cedric Mullins and Austin Hayes. I've talked about Mullins. The O's have got to get him going this season. He was so good for the O's last season. He has really struggled offensively so far this season. Mullins on Thursday night as the Orioles starting center fielder and number 1 batter was good. He was looking like his 2021 self, 2 for 4 with a 2-run double, another double, and a walk, and he had an outfield assist. And Austin Hayes on Thursday night as the Orioles starting left fielder and number 4 batter, 2 for 5 with 2 RBI singles and 2 walks. He got on base 4 times, also had an outfield assist. He has been terrific for the O's so far this season. Hayes this season now has an OPS of 826. Next up for the O's, a 3-game series against the Cleveland Guardians at Oriole Park at Camden Yards. Game 1 Friday night at 7:05. Bruce Zimmerman will be the Orioles starting pitcher. And that will do it for you and me for now. Keep the feedback coming. You can tweet me at Al Galdi. You can email me, thealgaldipodcast@yahoo.com. The weekend, always a good time to catch up on anything that you may have missed. I, on Tuesday's show, episode 325, had a good conversation with Michael Schaefer, senior editor at Politico, on the partisan nature of Congress investigating Dan Snyder and the commanders regarding the workplace misconduct and financial scandals. I, on Wednesday's show, episode 326, spoke with Mike Lewis, marketing professor at Emory University and the host of the Fanalytics with Mike Lewis podcast, on the commanders' fan base placing dead last in Mike's 2022 NFL fandom rankings. This Monday's show, episode 329, will feature all that you need to know from your Washington, D.C. sports weekend. I'll have lots more on the Commanders. I'll talk Nationals and Orioles as well. The Nats this weekend will play the final three games of a four-game series at the Cincinnati Reds in a battle of the two worst teams in the National League. The O's this weekend will face the Cleveland Guardians at Oriole Park at Camden Yards in a three-game series. Have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you on Monday.
This is Coach Norv Turner.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.